money. Money is a really, really tough subject for all of us. Not most of us, but I think for all of us in some way, whether we are rich or whether we're poor. And it's really refreshing to look at the Bible and see, what does it have to say about money and our relationship with it?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
You know, Jack, one of the subjects that I like the very, very, very least in life is money. I just wish, as my daughter would say, I wish I just had a magic wand and just could easily make things happen, like not have to worry about going to the bank and not have to worry about making it and not have to worry about if I'm investing it right or using it right. It just seems to be a major hassle. And yet, today, what we're going to be talking about is money. So, Jack, what does the Bible have to say about money? I hope it's encouraging, because since I like the subject so little, it would be really nice to hear some really great things from the Bible.
Well, I don't know how encouraging this is going to be. The passage that I had in mind here...
Jack, isn't your job to encourage me?
Paul warns Timothy that the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs.
Then that means since I hate money and don't love money, that I'm in a good place.
I'm not sure that's
not
what
quite
that
what
means.
It does. Okay.
But actually, maybe the passage we should look at is a parable that Jesus teaches in chapter 16 of Luke.
Okay, but in all seriousness, Jack, are we going to pass over that passage that you just read?
This parable talks about the same thing, I think. But, I mean, if you want to pursue something about that passage, we can. The reason that comes to mind, we often think of something like sexuality as being the biggest downfall of a person spiritually, because it's such a strong desire, a strong passion, a strong pull. But probably right up there with sexuality, if not even surpassing sexuality in our life, is money, I think. Money is a huge, huge temptation, a huge pull on us. And I think that's what you were starting, that's what you're talking about with your opening, is that the thing that we hate about it so much is that we don't have enough of it, usually.
And yeah, if we had plenty of it, it would be like a magic wand in some sense.
Exactly.
It would just make things easy.
Exactly.
It would make some things easy, and maybe it would make my sin bigger.
Right, right. But the things that we're thinking of in terms of being able to have whatever I wanted and not ever having to be disappointed, never having to exercise self-control, never having to deny myself of anything, a lot of money would supposedly give me that kind of freedom, which isn't really freedom, it's slavery, the Bible would say, but it appears to us, it has the illusion of being a kind of freedom. And it's being seduced by that kind of vision of, boy, if I just had the money, I'd be happier, I'd be freer, I'd have the kind of life that I want, is a very, very strong pull on all of us. On a couple of occasions, I've been driving down the freeway, and you see, here in Oregon, there's a big freeway sign strategically located in about three spots that I can think of that talks about how many millions of dollars you can win in the lottery. And with nothing else to do on a long drive, I find myself calculating, well, what could I do with that, you know, with a gazillion dollars or
Yeah, and I know what's
dollars?
Top on your list.
Oh, yeah? What's that?
A Harley.
No, actually, I'm more pious than that. I think in terms of how much I want to give away first and, you know, how much I want to give away to this and to that and what I want to help with this and what I want to help with that. And then what's really interesting is to watch my mind, because I don't care how many gazillion dollars it is, there's always not enough. And it's astonishing to me. And the reason there's not enough is because as much as I'm thinking of giving away, there's so much more that I'm keeping. I'm giving away more than I'm keeping, but the more I give away, the more justified I feel in keeping a lot. And my appetite is bigger than my plans for what I can lovingly and piously do with the money and fulfill my appetite too. My appetite's too big for that. And it's a kind of a shocking realization, because mostly in my life, I don't have enough money to be particularly greedy with, so it's not really a problem. But it's really interesting when I start imagining the possibility that I would have those resources, it's amazing what kind of impulses arise in me. It's just greed. I mean, there's no way to make it a prettier picture. It's ugly human greed.
So when you don't have the money, as you usually don't, it could appear to you as though you're not very greedy.
Mm-hmm.
But once you kind of let yourself go on this fantasy adventure into having money, the greed pops up all over the place. And I just have to ditto that. That's exactly what I do. I mean, I usually am like you. I don't think about what I'm going to buy for myself first. I do think about, oh, wow, I could give to this organization or that. And it's kind of exciting,
mm-hmm.
I must admit, to think, wow, there would be a lot to give. But what I want then increases, you know, mm-hmm. Wow, what about a house in Hawaii? Ooh. Well, if there's a house in Hawaii, I think I might travel a lot. I'd go to Spain and live there for a year. You know?
Where, the houses start multiplying.
Yeah. Yeah. Where,
exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Right now, you know, I don't go away for very many weekends, and it certainly isn't to my own cabin, but all of a sudden I have 10 houses all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, not quite that bad, but, you know, it does multiply.
Yeah, and that's I think, what that passage is talking about, the love of money. That is the love of what money can buy, obviously, I think, is what he's talking about. The love of what seems like a kind of freedom and a kind of power that money can give. If I allow myself to be captivated by that, it's addictive. And like so many desires, that if I go with the desire, if I indulge in the desire, it just actually increases my appetite. We think that if we just indulge the desire a measured amount, a little bit, then that'll just kind of take care of it. But in fact, there's certain addictive kinds of desires in us that they just, the more we think about it, the more we want it, the more we allow the desire room in us, the greater our appetite for it becomes.
You know, I was just thinking about something in regard to this. Before we started the show, we were talking about the fact that we are trying to sell our house. I think I mentioned this on the program, and buying another one. And the other one that we're buying, I said, I don't like. And what occurred to me, what just flashed into my mind, and I'm not sure of this, but I'm a little persuaded that it might be true, is that we're going from a larger house to a much smaller house. And it might be that it's just really tough for me to not have, to have to give up some of what has felt so comfortable for me in some ways, and to have to live with less.
Mm-hmm.
You know, less room up to the ceiling, you know, lower ceilings, smaller rooms, smaller kitchen, less storage space. It's kind of, if I had all the money in the world, I probably wouldn't be doing this. I would be maybe going for more. And so it's kind of the reverse of what we've been talking about. It's tough to give up
mm-hmm.
what I have come to feel comfortable with. And it's really good exercise for me to do this, and a difficult one.
Yeah.
Think that could be it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what I would respond to, is that any kind of self-limitation comes very difficult for us. I think it's just part of our natural self-centered evil that we are as human beings, that we really balk at the notion that I would have to allow any limitations in my life. And so the actual going from not being limited in some respect to being limited is very difficult for us.
It's very difficult. And what's happening for me is I don't have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do it because it was forced upon me financially. I'm doing it because I think it's the right thing to do. And because, well, there's other reasons too, but that's a big reason. And as I come down to the reality of actually doing it, not just the theory, it is admittedly difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And you know this other bad thing that comes out in me, and I'm embarrassed to say this one, but one of the reasons that we're moving is because we live in a larger house in our area than there are houses. The houses around us are smaller and more modest, and my children have been a little embarrassed by it. And I always, because, you know, they're seen as having more than the other kids at their school. And I always thought that it didn't matter to me that what it appeared like to other people just didn't have any bearing on it. And in fact, we bought this place because it had an office in back, and we wanted a counseling office on the premises so that we could be close to our children. And that was really the fundamental reason for this particular place. But now that we're leaving, I see that popping up in me, Jack, and I just hate it.
You see what popping up?
That there is some pride in having a nice place, and that having just kind of a regular old place kind of shoots some prideful arrows through me. Like, ooh, this is not very significant.
And
I don't like seeing that, but it's a good thing for me to see.
Mm-hmm.
It's a yucky thing for me to see.
Mm-hmm.
How come we're not better than this?
Yeah, I know. That's the thing that's astonishing to me is the more I grow, the wiser I become. Nonetheless, things in life will come along that will bring out of me stuff that I know is wrong, that I've taught is wrong, that I have seen clearly and articulated why it's wrong. And yet just this natural spontaneous impulse that is so obviously ugly, but it's me. You know, it's there. It's the reality of my own heart and who I am and where I'm coming from. Yeah, it's not real pretty.
Yeah, it's, when you really look inside, it's not a pretty picture.
Yeah.
And it really, though, brings me to the place of, oh, I get it. I'm the one that needed the cross.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the guy next door. That one, that was for me. That was really for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing to know. That's a good thing to learn.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it hurts.
I mean, one of the things that passage was talking about, we've been talking about just, you know, how ingrained that in us and is in us and how natural that can be to us. But what Paul is warning Timothy about is about people who have actually strayed from the faith, he said, because of the love of money. And that's another thing to look at, is that he, you know, what he's saying is, this is so seductive and this is so powerful that there are people who, when it comes right down to it, to making a choice between, are you going to go for the money or are you going to keep your faith, they go for the money. And the faith is not valuable enough to them to want to pursue it and hang on to it and persevere in it. We could talk about the different ways that could look. You know, one way, for example, is you have to wonder when you have Bible teachers who go on television or radio or wherever they go on, I suppose usually television, and there has to come some juncture in their life, some critical point in their life where they recognize that they've got some influence here, they've got some pull, they've got some sway. They could turn that influence that they have into money, or they could use that to serve people for their eternal well-being. And I must say, it sure looks to me like there's a whole class of people who at that juncture, they turn that into money. I can get people's money coming my way in the name of Jesus, in the name of Christianity, in the name of truth, in the name of, you know, being a Bible teacher. Well, I think Paul would look at that and say they have strayed from the faith. They made a choice. They decided that they were going to go for the money and not remain faithful disciples and faithful servants of the truth. Businessmen, faced with a critical choice. Is my integrity, is my honesty, is my regard for what's right and good and true enough that I'm willing to lose this deal, not get this account, whatever. It's going to cost me big bucks here. Is my integrity worth it? And how many times, how many businessmen say, no, my integrity is not worth it. I want the money. And that may be just a moment of weakness, a moral lapse, but in a lot of people's lives, it's a fundamental life-defining, life-changing choice. They're actually choosing money over the kingdom of God. And I think that's what Paul, it's in those cases that Paul is saying, look, they strayed from the faith because of the love of money. So this is powerful stuff, and we can't take it lightly.
And you use the examples of maybe a TV evangelist and a businessman, and it happens in much more mundane ways also. I can, for example, withhold information in selling my house because maybe someone won't want to buy it if they know this or that. I know before we put our house on the market, we did a whole bunch of stuff to it to kind of improve it in ways that were maybe not necessary, but I knew that those things existed, and I thought they needed to be brought up. And it was hard because it cost us quite a bit of money. Not tons of money, but we had to spend some money in order to make it happen. And maybe there are things that people wouldn't notice, but I noticed. And so it was that decision. Am I going to love money, and or am I going to do what I think is right? And in my mind, doing those improvements were right. And at this point, as I sell my house, as far as I know, things are in order. And that feels good. But I think we can get away with it. And that's what happens a lot. We try and get away with it, and nobody will notice. And it's sacrificing someone else's well-being very often for my pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jesus would clearly call that wrong, and I'm compromising my discipleship with Jesus when I make that choice. I'm very vulnerable to that. For the most part, I do pretty well at honesty, but I really feel vulnerable at that area. It's easy for me to rationalize, well, I wouldn't care if I were them, so they won't care either. Well, that's not for me to decide. And to rationalize it in that way is just really a corrupt thing to do. It really lacks integrity.
What's difficult for you? Because I think when people listen to us sometimes, Jack, the feedback I've gotten is that we sound a whole lot better than we really are. Like you guys, since you're on the radio, you kind of don't struggle with what we struggle with. But I think we're all earthlings that struggle in the same way. So the more we can talk about, the nitty-gritty of where we struggle, it's not making us different than other people.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I were selling a car, for example, and I know of four or five things that kind of concern us or bother us or a problem to us that have mounted up and have got so irritating that we want to unload this car or we don't want to deal with it any longer. If someone were coming to look at it and ask, well, why are you selling it? What I really ought to say is, well, there's four or five things here that have bugged me so much that I want to unload this thing because I'm tired of dealing with it. That's the truth. But it would be very easy for me to rationalize it along the lines of, and this is probably true, that I don't really know what's wrong because I'm so mechanically inept that I have no clue what's wrong. All I know is that I sense that something is not right. That leak probably was not put there by the manufacturer
probably not.
Things like that. So since I can't really inform them intelligently, it would be easy for me to rationalize, well, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know if the car is sound or not sound. Well, but I suspect that there's some problems. So why don't I be forthright about, well, I suspect there's some problems. And normally I bring myself to do that, to do the right thing, but it's really a struggle for me. I really feel the temptation to kind of just not say more than I know.
You've just knocked $500 off the car, price
right.
of the car if you do that.
Exactly.
And that's the love of money that we're talking about.
Or quashed the deal entirely and have missed an opportunity to unload it. I was very struck reading, I might have mentioned this before, but I was very struck once reading a Roman ethical philosopher. I think it was Cicero. It might have been somebody else. But he gives an example of, you've got this island in the Mediterranean, and it has a food shortage. And a boat comes with loaded with corn, and you're the captain of the boat or the owner of the boat or whatever. And you know that there's three more boats coming loaded with corn as you're starting to sell this corn on the island. You know that they're coming. The people don't know those boats are coming. So you're in an advantageous position. You could charge a lot more for this corn, and they're going to be willing to pay it, because as far as they know, this is all, there's a scarcity. This is the only, all there is to the supply. So the law of supply and demand would drive the price of your corn up. He asked the question, do you have a moral obligation to let the people know that you know the other boats are coming? And his answer to that, to my astonishment, was absolutely. Of course you have a moral obligation to let them know that it's coming. And what rebuked me in reading that is how ready I would have been to rationalize that. And I would have told myself something like, well, I could tell them the boats are coming, but what if they sink before they get here? Then I've misinformed them. So I don't want to misinform them, of course. So the noble thing for me to do is to just be quiet about that. And, you know, we'll see whether they show up or whether they don't show up.
Well,
you know,
scary,
here's this
we?
Pagan philosopher who knows better than I do.
Yeah.
Well, of course you have an obligation to tell them the boats are coming.
Yeah, that's a no-brainer, he's mm-hmm. saying.
Yeah, he did. I mean, that's what was so striking to him is how much of a no-brainer that one was. And yet, our self-protective, greedy instincts trump our commitment to what's right and true and just and fair so often. But anyway, I think that's what that First Timothy passage is talking about. That love of the illusory power and freedom that money brings mm-hmm. can be so seductive that it can lead us into compromising our integrity at the least, and it can even go so far as to make us abandon the faith altogether.
And it isn't that we're talking about an error or a wrong decision. We're talking about a style of life that is just characterized by greed.
Right.
An insatiable greed that says what I want is more important than what's right, and that's generally where I'm going to go. I'm thinking of an example right now that I was buying a bunch of sandwiches at Subway, and I was thinking, man, I wish I hadn't come to Subway. It costs so much. I wish I was just gone to Safeway and bought the meat and made the sandwiches, but gosh, that would have taken time. And I was kind of going through all that in my mind as they were making these sandwiches, and I was adding it up. Oh, man, it's going to be this much. And so I came to the cash register, and she says, it's this amount.
And miscalculated.
And I thought, ooh, well, that's like 10 bucks less than I thought. That's great. Then I thought, no, Christine, you're just justifying it. You know they had to have made a mistake for you only to be paying $14 when it should be like $27. You just added that up in your mind. So I said, so reluctantly, you know what? I think that's got to be wrong. And he said, no, I think it's right. He was thinking I thought it was more than it should be by his comments. And I said, no, I don't think you have charged me enough. And he just kind of looked at me like, what? He goes, oh, well, let's go over this. And I was right. He had not charged me enough, but it was like, oh, I really could have gotten away with that. And it's so seductive. So I'm talking about, all my examples have been where I have done well today. Like, I think I have my house in order, and I think, to the best of my knowledge, it's in great condition. And, you know, I did ride at Subway. But I just had this little thought creep into my mind. There was this sports fee for my son that I was supposed to pay last year. And I just thought, I don't know if I paid that. And then I thought, well, it's over. They won't know. Then I thought, but that's wrong. And it's really easy for me to justify and say it's over. And if they didn't contact me, then I guess it's fine. But, you know, the reality is I don't know if it's fine. And I really don't want to have to find out. And I really should. And I guess I will make myself accountable and say, I will. Ooh, and it's even holiday time and it's expensive. But it isn't that I would make one error and even not be willing to look at that. That would mean that I'd lost my faith or would bring condemnation on me. It would be that that would be my lifestyle, that it wouldn't matter to me, that I wouldn't even have a conscience that would ring the bell.
Yeah. And that is the thing that is astonishing, that you see people in the world who, you put it very well, it's like they don't even have any conscience with regard to that any longer. They are so committed, it makes so much sense to them to protect themselves and get as much money out of you as they can and get away with as much as they can. That makes so much sense to them that for you to even raise a moral question against it just seems bizarre to them.
Foolish.
They think you're from another planet.
Well, and foolish.
Yeah.
Exactly. Wait a minute. This is everybody out for themselves. This is not a win-win situation. This is, I'm going to win regardless. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of people who are pretty callous to it.
Yeah.
And I see how one could get there. I see how I could have gotten there. Mm-hmm. Thank God I'm not there. And mm-hmm. That's literal. Thank God. Because he brought us to the place to have a conscience. And that's a good thing.
Yep.
But I'm afraid I'm out another $85. Okay. So let's look at the passage some more.
Yeah, this is in Luke chapter 16, and it's the what they call, often labeled, the parable of the unrighteous steward. Now he was also saying to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and this manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be manager. The manager said to himself, what shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I am not strong enough to dig. I am ashamed to beg. I know what I will do, so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes. And he summoned each one of his master's debts, and he began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, then how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and write 80. And his master praised the unrighteous manager because he acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much, and he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust the true riches to you? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. This is a parable that I think a lot of people have a hard time with, because it sounds like Jesus is praising this steward for his lack of integrity, for his being an embezzler and a cheat. And he is. That is what he's doing. It's exactly what he's doing. But we misunderstand the nature of the parable if we stumble over that, because there's a lot of parables where on the surface level, on the story level, the people who are acting are not being particularly admirable or kind or generous or faithful or whatever. Oftentimes they're being sinful and corrupt and evil or selfish or whatever. But that's not the point. I mean, it's not that these people are exemplary people. It's that there's an analogy that can be drawn between something about the way they're behaving and something else. And that's exactly what's going on here. What Jesus is saying is there's an analogy that can be drawn between how this fraudulent, cheating embezzler is operating, the logic of what he's doing. There's something about that we need to learn from. So what is that? Well, first of all, what's the story? In the ancient world, you had rich, wealthy people. Usually in Palestine, they were landholders who they owned some land, and the land produced wealth for them, crops of one kind, livestock, something. And they would hire someone to be a manager. It's like a foreman on a ranch in the Western United States. It's like the manager of a business. You know, somebody might own a business, but they may spend their time traveling around the world. The actual hands-on operation of running the business is left in the hands of a manager.
Like a lot of people have rental properties and they give it to a management company to take care of for them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what a steward was, or a man, they're calling it a manager here. This wealthy man would hire somebody to manage his properties. Well, as the manager, he had all kinds of authority, all kinds of latitude. He was the one who entered into contracts with other people. He sold this, bought this, paid the servants their wage, fed the servants, took care of them. I mean, he was in charge of, so he had a lot of power, a lot of authority. He was in charge of all the holdings of the landowner. So, of course, you wanted him to be trustworthy. I mean, you expected your manager to be trustworthy. Well, this manager has been squandering the landholder's possessions. I think all that means is that he's been not a particularly good, what's the word I'm looking for? Has not been very fiscally responsible. He's wasting a lot of stuff. I don't think he's been embezzling, actually. I've called him embezzler, but I think that's a mistake. I don't think he's been embezzling. I just think he's been, up to this point, he hasn't been very frugal, hasn't been very responsible. So the landowner comes to him and says, look, you're wasting all my possessions. You're not being a particularly good manager. I want you to bring me the books. You're fired. So bring me the books tomorrow. And so by the books, he means the records. I think some of them, it says give an account, but the word in Greek that's used for give an account also is the word that they would use for the literal physical record.
The accounting books,
exactly. So here's what this manager reasons. He says, well, tomorrow I'm not going to have these books. I've got them for 24 hours. What can I do here? So he thinks, I know. I can make a lot of people indebted to me, you know, kind of morally and socially indebted to me, if I use the power and authority that I have now to give them some advantage, then they owe me.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. They're going to owe me.
Exactly. So he goes to all these debtors and he says, you know, how much do you owe? I owe 100, something or other. Let's make it 50. So write out, I imagine it's some kind of IOU. Change the IOU that you now possess. I've got it in my possession, our copy of it. Change it to 50. You write it out. I'll sign it. We'll make it in duplicate, and I will replace the IOU that is now in the books with this one for half the amount. And he goes to each of his debtors and does that kind of scheme. Well, now he literally is embezzling, sort of. He's cheating his master. But what he recognizes is, the reason I'm going to cheat my master is, if he finds out, if he catches me, what's he going to do? Fire me? I mean, the point is, I've already lost my job. I have nothing to lose here, so I'm willing to risk losing this position of security I'm in because I've already lost it. It's already gone. Now, what he's doing is utterly dishonest. It's utterly immoral. There's nothing right about it. But there's something about the logic of what he's doing that Jesus says is very shrewd.
Because what's happening is his employer actually is gaining at least 50% of what he had, what was owed to him. Instead of nothing, he's getting 50% or some of it. This manager is having people indebted to him for future resources, and the people who had the debt are out of 50% of it. So it's kind of like, in his mind, everybody's coming out a winner, especially himself.
Yeah, especially himself. Yeah. I don't know about the landowner. I mean, I don't think this is the case of sometimes we have people who think they have an uncollectible debt and they'd rather get 50 cents on the dollar than nothing. I don't think that's what's going on here. I think these are debts that these people would have actually paid. So I think the landowner really is not coming out ahead. I think he's just plain losing in this deal.
Okay.
Why does he not make it 100%? Well, I think he's trying to cover his tracks. I think he's trying to keep this as invisible and as hidden from his master as he can, if possible. So he only reduces it a significant amount, enough to make these debtors indebted to him, but not enough that'll make it obvious to the landowner that he's
been cheated. Okay, so the possibility here is that the landowner might think he got fully paid back,
right?
Because they had fixed the books and there's some money that's on the table that looks significant enough.
Yeah, and I think in that culture that would be very plausible, because I think the landowners are not very hands-on. They have no idea what kind of indebtedness is coming to them. Only the manager knows that, and the manager is using that knowledge and the ignorance of his landowner to his advantage.
So Jesus is not saying, wow, this is great that you learned to be this dishonest. Rather, the guy's really using his head. He's being, the word he uses is shrewd, creative in regard to what he does. And perhaps we need to learn from him in terms of being shrewd or creative, not in a dishonest way, but in an honest way.
Right. And with respect to one particular issue, I mean, that's the key to understanding the parable. I mean, Jesus is not coming along and trying to teach us how to do money, how to do economics, how to do business, how to do financial relationships. He's not talking about that at all. What he's talking about is, he says, there's kind of an analogy here. You people are in exactly the same position that steward was in, that manager was in. Do you know that? Do you understand that? Do you see that? Now, what do I mean by the exactly the same position?
That your souls are in that position?
Well, kind of, yeah. You're in that position because here you are, you've got a job. God has entrusted you with the financial resources that you have, with the stuff that you have, with the earning potential that you have, all the ways of making money that you have. God has entrusted that to you. Do you know that you've already been fired? And what he means by that is that the slogan that we use all the time, you can't take it with you. I mean, do you know that the end of your life is your termination date from this job that you've got? That there's no more earning potential after that? All the money that you have does not belong to you any longer? All of your ownership of the stuff that you own ceases on the day that you die. Then what? That situation is exactly like this manager was in. He saw the day up ahead, 24 hours from now, when all of the authority and power and resources that were at his disposal were suddenly no longer going to be at his disposal. And what he did is he realized the short time between now and then, I'm going to use the financial power at my disposal to secure my future. Rather than take care of myself now, I'm going to secure my future. What Jesus is saying is, you guys aren't shrewd enough to do the same thing. But you should, because you have a whole eternity beyond that termination point that you ought to be desirous of taking care of. You need to take care of that future, but here you are, you're so focused on the present right now that you're too stupid to take care of the future. Now, how would you do that? How would you take care of the future in our situation? Well, you would recognize that just like this manager realized, well, I could make some friends out there with the money that I've got now. We ought to be making friends right now with the money that's at my disposal right now. Well, who are the relevant friends? God. God is. Basically, what he's saying is, you ought to be making friends with God with the financial resources that you have now. Use those financial resources to make friends with God, because he's the only one that's going to count after the termination date.
Boy, that almost sounds like, let's just manipulate God into thinking I'm a good guy. And I don't think that's where you're going at all.
No, no. But it does sound like that. Certainly,
it really
does. Sounds like let's buy off God.
Yeah, no, that's a better way to say it. Let's buy off God. Okay, here's a new strategy. God will feel pleased with me if I give, 90% of that lottery money away to people, and I just hope I get, $10 million, because that'll leave me a good chunk still.
Right. And that, of course, would get us nowhere, because that wouldn't make friends with God. Unlike people, God can't be fooled. God can't be bribed. God can't be manipulated. God can't be compromised. So there's no way in the world that I can say, well, God, for $100,000, will you ignore everything else wrong in my life? No, that it ain't going to work. God doesn't work that way. But what I can do is I can be faithful with the use of my money. I can use my money as a tool for accomplishing what God wants me to accomplish, loving other people, showing compassion, being just, being fair, being equitable, all the ways in which I can use my money to be an expression and an embodiment of the values of God's kingdom. And Jesus is, by analogy, likening that to making friends with God, making friends for myself in heavenly places, or however he put it. And I think that's a very apt analogy. I mean, the reason he calls it making friends with God is because he wants to draw an analogy with his story. That's the only reason he calls it that. But it's a very apt analogy. I mean, the thing that, if I really want to be enlightened, if I really want to be smart about this, I need to recognize that there is no such thing as financial security in the long run. In the ultimate scheme of things, finances don't bring any kind of security at all. I ought to recognize that, and therefore, instead of spending all of my life striving for financial security, I ought to strive for eternal security instead. I ought to strive for being right with God and seeing my money as one of the tools at my disposal for embodying that pursuit of being right with God. And those will often work at cross purposes to one another. Because if the logic of my life is I want to be financially secure, then I will watch my savings account grow and grow and grow and grow, and there will be no end to how much more I want in my savings account. That's the logic of financial security. But the logic of eternal security is I might actually find myself using this savings account that I've bought to give it away out of compassion, out of love, out of justice or righteousness or whatever. I will find some reason why I might want to give that to somebody else instead of keeping it for myself, hoarding it for myself. Why would I do that? Because I want to do the right thing rather than the financially secure thing. Why would you want to do the right thing? Because doing the right thing is, in the long run, from the standpoint of eternity, putting me in a much more secure position than finances ever could put me in. That's what he's trying to say in this parable.
Jack, a couple of weeks ago, I said, when I ask you a question, you just kind of sound like a history book. And today I have a new description of you. It's when you ask a question, you're not necessarily a history book. You're also a sermon. It's hard for me to believe how much you just came up with all that information, and I don't think you prepared for it at all.
Well, that's true, except I've had a lifetime of preparing for that. I mean, I've been studying the Bible for many, many years. And
you did a great job. I guess that's a different way of saying that. I think you did a great job at helping us look at that parable and seeing what it's saying, because it's not an easy parable to look at and to understand. So what I'm going to do real quickly, if I may, is kind of review what you said about the parable and what it means.
Great, yeah.
The parable is kind of saying, you know, money is a big, big issue in life, and we've got to really come to terms with how we're going to see it, how we're going to use it. So let me give you an example of a guy who was really thinking. And it's a difficult example because it looks like he's telling us to go really in a bad and wrong direction. And so even as I'm trying to go back and talk about it, it's difficult to do this. But generally, the man in the parable was thinking ahead, knowing that there was an end in sight. That's parallel to us in real life. There is an end that we might not see, but it's in sight to God. Our lives will end. Our job of earning and spending money and living life will be done someday. And it's like soon. I mean, the guy only had 24 hours, and we may have many, many years, but it's really pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we need to do is think in terms of not, we'll always have time, but we're out of time. And let's use the time that we have to do what's right. And what's right is to use our money for the purposes of God. And I think that's basically what he was saying.
Right.
I think that a difficult question after you got over that very difficult question is, so what is using my money for the purposes of God?
Good question, yes.
Which you brought up, and you said, well, maybe you used the example of maybe I should use my retirement money to give to some other person or cause or something because it seems right. And I would hate for people to turn off their radios after this hour and run out and give all their money to something because that's what Jack said. And I don't think that's necessarily right. It's not that easy. It's not that clear. If I have retirement money, it might be that it's very wise for me to keep that money because if I don't, I might be a burden on society in a way
Yes. In
my old age that I could use this money to pay for the hospital bills or the home that I need to stay in or to help my children take care of me. That might be a really wise way to use my retirement money and really, in fact, wrong and unkind to, in essence, ask my community to pay for it because I've decided that I'm just going to go give this away. So when we think about how do we use our money in a right way, that's part of what I don't like about money because it's hard to figure that out.
Yeah, it is. It is.
What's right? What's best? Is it best to do this or is it best to do that? And, you know, I kind of get stuck in a place of I really don't know. And the answers really aren't very clear. And I think that's true because it really isn't clear, Jack. It really is gray. I'm back to my house thing, but I'm in this dilemma of I've had this office behind my house and it seems wise to downsize, but now I have to get another office. And you know what that means? It means I'm going to have to drive across town. I'm not going to be as available to my children. And I'm thinking now I'm selling my house and I'm taking away. And I'm not having to spend maybe as much money here, but maybe I will there. And did I make a right decision? And I'm trying to do it right, but I don't know. And I'm kind of caught in that dilemma a lot. I don't know. I could put money in retirement. I have this money to put in retirement, or I could give it to McKinsey Study Center. Which way do I go? Which is best? Would the retirement be better? Because ultimately, that's going to be a right decision because maybe it's even good for my children not to have to take care of me and I'm kind of taking care of myself and being responsible. Or is it better to buy a roof for the study center today? And I get lost a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe we need to spend a whole lot more time on that because that's a very important question. Just briefly, in a nutshell, I think we have to remember it's not what we do, but what heart is motivating that is ultimately the crucial issue. We may make all kinds of bad judgment, misjudgments, miscalculations in really what we can and can't afford, what we should and shouldn't do. From God's perspective, He may have called it differently. But the important thing is what's motivating me greed, or is what's motivating me a desire to obey God? That's in the end the ultimate question. We may make mistakes in our financial decisions, but God is not going to blame us for being finite human beings who can't figure this out. It's the heart that's wrong that is what condemns us, and we need to keep that in perspective. And otherwise, maybe in the future we can sort out some of these other issues.
Jack and Christine will return in a moment. Almost 20 years ago, the McKinsey Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, McKinsey has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant, a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The McKinsey staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible. Individually, they want to know what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible. They want to peel away layers of false teaching and get to the very heart of the biblical message. And this is not easy. It's hard work.
It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. These men and women also believe their studies and their teaching are not perfect. They know their understanding is limited, and they may be wrong, but they trust God to give them the eyes to clearly see His truth. They also encourage others to join them in their efforts, to ask them tough questions, to challenge their conclusions, and to take the Bible seriously. More importantly, they desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Much of the teaching done at McKenzie is available on tape and can be ordered from the tape catalog. Papers and the free monthly newsletter, News and Views, are also available. Information about how you can find out more about McKenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
It has been really exciting, a really good thing for Jack and I to get together and dialogue about so many different issues with the backdrop of the Bible, trying to understand the Bible better, trying to understand how it fits into our lives in a real practical way. In addition to the radio, we've been trying to think about what are some other ways that we can dialogue with our listening audience and with other people to perhaps even expand the audience that wants to listen to what's being taught here at Christianity at Work. So we came up with the idea of offering seminars or workshops to people out there in your community. We would like to offer this for a weekend retreat, for a women's group, for your support group, for a men's group, a women's group, a home group, for your church, for schools, for colleges, just about any group that wants to get together and put together a workshop. We'd be really excited to help you out. The format that we're thinking about is an interactive one. Just as you hear on Christianity at Work, Jack and I are interacting with each other. The topic could be one of your choice. It is really wide open for us. What you want to have us present, we'd be very happy to do that. We also appreciate the dialogue between ourselves and our listening audience. We've had a couple of times where we've gone out to different communities, and that has just been a wonderful thing to get to know you, to see you, to interact with you personally, face to face. So your questions would be a big part of what we would do in any seminar. Depending on the response, we may not be able to meet everybody's needs, but we're going to try and do the best that we can. If you're interested in this, we invite you to contact McKenzie Study Center. It's at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And the telephone number is 541-485-4801. And those addresses will be, and phone number will be repeated at the end of the program. We hope to hear from you.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.